Welcome to The Spot, KALW's showcase for the best in public radio podcasts. First up this week, it's Radio Ambulante, compelling human stories from around Latin America and the United States. Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
I felt this sense of hate brewing, and art was a way to challenge that in such a kind of positive way. And when I saw the power of that, I was like, wow, I mean, this is how I can have a voice.
Welcome to Radio Ambulante, Unscripted, a part of Soundworks from PRI. I'm Daniel Alarcón. If you don't know Fabiana Rodriguez by name, you may still have seen her work. She's one of the visual artists most intimately involved with the immigrants' rights movement, and her art seems to be everywhere, at marches, on college campuses, stenciled on the walls and vacant lots in East Oakland, where she's from. The fact that these pieces are so easily reproduced is part of the point. Fabiana wants to spark conversation. She wants to provide templates for others, students, activists, people from all walks of life, to play with images and make them their own. So to begin, I asked Fabiana to describe one of her more iconic pieces, The Butterfly.
The butterfly is something that I was observing, and it was in different immigration spaces. It had been used in Arizona. And initially, believe it or not, I was really kind of turned off by it because I'm a feminist artist. And then when I saw how people reacted to it, and I noticed especially how children would react to it, and that for me was, you know, when I saw that, I was like, you know what, I really want to give this more life. I want it to be everywhere. And I really fell in love with it as a metaphor. What I did is I put two faces in it that are looking at themselves as a way to also say that these can be two nations or two families.
In the wings.
Yeah. And then I wanted to provide the cultural tools so that people could participate and create their own butterflies.
Fabi, when did you decide you wanted to be an artist?
I knew I wanted to be an artist since I was a child, I would say 8 to 10 years old. I was really gifted in the arts, so much that I would win awards for kids. I mean, I was on Univision for winning the drawing awards. I would win the library awards. And art was something I kind of did as a hobby because my mom realized that I really loved to do it. And so she enrolled me in a lot of programs in the Fruitvale where I grew up. And I was trained by some of the most prolific Chicano muralists in the Bay Area in things like screen printing and murals. And it was very important for me to learn from Chicanos and from Nicaraguenses who were also working in the Fruitvale because it gave me an idea that art was about reflecting what I saw
right.
in my community.
It seems to me like there's a tension in the art world. There's like art that is part of an activist agenda or activist movement, and then there's so-called fine arts that are kind of devoid of explicit politics or stripped of that in a different way. And I was wondering, as you developed your practice as an artist, how much did that tension weigh on you, and did you feel pulled in one direction or the other, and how did you make the choice to do the kind of art that you ended up doing?
Yeah, well, actually, I mean, I didn't even know that there was an art world out there that would welcome me. And I think that, you know, one of the biggest kind of secrets or the white elephant in the room with the art world is just the sheer racial inequality that exists at all levels, everything from who is attending the schools, the art schools, to who's teaching. My education around the arts and where I saw it most powerfully used was to challenge some of the political issues that were happening when I was growing up, and one of them being Proposition 187.
Right. So how old were you when Prop 187 came out?
I was 15.
Okay. And did your Fruitvale High School mobilize and get super involved?
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is where, for me, it really clicked how powerful art was, because there was a flyer that was being put up all over our neighborhood that said, "Who's the illegal alien pilgrim?" And it has an Aztec guy wrinkling these papers. And it really, I was like, whoa, like, I've never seen anything that challenged whiteness like that and that challenged. But I felt this sense of kind of hate brewing. And art was a way to challenge that in such a kind of positive way. And when I saw the power of that, I was like, wow, I mean, this is how I can have a voice.
Do you think that, you know, if we're looking, if we're 30 years from now and we're looking mm-hmm. back at this moment, certain images are going to survive. What do you think is going to last? Like, if we're curating this 30 years from now, what are we going to see on the walls of a gallery or a museum?
Well, first, we're going to definitely see the concept of the physical wall be broken down. And I think some of the most interesting projects, both, you know, as performance pieces or as visual pieces, have the wall has crumbled. The wall doesn't exist anymore.
What do you mean by
that? Or the wall, like I've seen, you know, performance art where people are doing volleyball over the wall, or where people are exchanging something over the wall, or even, you know, civil disobedience where people are hugging each other through the wall and crying in each other's arms because they can't be with each other. I think first that the concept of the wall is so unique to the U.S.-Mexico border and so symbolic of everything that's wrong with immigration policy, that is one kind of element that I see over and over again continuing to show up in the work. And so I think that that's something that we would see even continuing 30 years from now, and I think evolved on a whole nother level.
Aesthetically, there's been some development. Mm-hmm. Building upon the legacy of, say, the Chicano muralists or yeah. the graphic arts of the Black Panther Party, or, you know, a lot of the iconography that we know that had an activist bent a generation ago. But some of that iconography has been transformed. Some of it has been rejected. Some of it has been improved upon. I'd love it if you could describe to me aesthetically, in terms of the art, what's happened. Like, how is the art pushed into it now?
Well, first, we have entirely different tools we're working with. I mean, we have digital tools at our disposal, which means that art, the way in which art can respond to an urgency of, say, what's happening at the Arizona border or what's happening with a deportation, has the ability to reach audiences and viewers so much quicker than it did in the past.
Because of the viral sharing.
Because of the sharing, but also it both becomes a reflection of the cultural moment as much as a tool to shape that moment. So when youth in 2010 began to come out, undocumented youth mm-hmm. started coming out as undocumented and unafraid, this was a challenge to even, you know, the previous narratives that the immigration movement had said, because they were saying, yes, we're undocumented and we are now going to tell you we're undocumented. We're going to have rallies to tell you. We're going to put it on YouTube. We're going to put it on Facebook. And it created this kind of mass domino effect where youth in different cities were coming out with their stories. That impacted the art in the sense where the art was very unapologetic. It was no longer about just saying we are workers, not criminals. It was more about saying we're not going anywhere.
It seems that the challenge then is, how do you make art that also builds bridges?
Right. I that's correct. I think also, I mean, as an artist, this is where I think an artist has to be an artist. And that is that I don't believe that our content must always be driven by the policy moment. Sometimes we have to remember our basic humanity. I mean, that is, art is a bridge to that. It's a bridge to remind people that we experience the same sadness and joys, and that we are also human beings. And I mean, when I see the art come out, I just think to myself, how can I make this so that more people participate? How can I make these tools available to folks who are not immigrants, whose families have been here multiple generations? How can I speak to white families and Black families and Asian families so that these tools are also used by a multitude of people? And that's something that I think is much more relevant to me, is how do we incorporate the creation of culture with an end goal? Because I don't think we're just making culture, just making stuff just to make it. I mean, I think that there's a thinking behind why these tools are needed and why they will uplift stories, and therefore thinking with a long-term goal of what we want to shift is key to my practice.
Fabiana Rodriguez is an artist and activist from Oakland, California. This interview was engineered and produced by Claire Mullen with editing from Silvia Viñas. Special thanks to our production intern, Diana Buendia, and our program associate, Lori Ignacio. Carolina Guerrero is our executive director. Thanks also to KALW in San Francisco. Radio Ambulante Unscripted is supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. Radio Ambulante tells the stories of Latin America. To hear more, please visit our website, radioambulante.org. I'm Daniel Alarcón. Thanks for listening.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
What's that you playing?
You're listening to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts.
You're listening to Life of the Law, a radio show taking a look at the legal system and how it works.
Law is more than the policeman on the corner, more than the courthouse where our laws are enforced, more than the jail where lawbreakers are punished. In your whole community, there are customs and moral codes which guide your actions. What social controls affect you?
I mean, it's against the law. Having an open container in a park, I do believe.
Mr. Fisher,
Mr. Fido,
we're not friends anymore.
You told me that 3 months ago.
I know.
This is Life of the Law. I'm Nancy Mullane. Everyone likes a great public park. If there's a river or a stream running through it, all the better to swim in the summer and ice skate in the winter. The oldest city park in America, the Boston Common, was created in 1634, so farm families had a place to graze their cows. Over time, as more people moved into cities like Boston, city governments began to buy land to create pleasure grounds so people had a place to relax in nature. But not everyone likes to share public space the same way. The question is, when to bring in the law? Jason Albert has the story.
I live on the bank of the Deschutes River. In this stretch of about a block, the river divides two distinct sides of our city, the east and the west. The riverbank is a public space open for everyone, but people don't always agree on how to best spend a hot summer day. Davis Park is on the east side of the river. It has the perfect combination of shade and privacy for people to hang out, let loose. Teenagers used to come here to make out or drink some beers. Now, on hot days, it's where many go to cool off, including the down and out. On the west side of the river, where I live, things like birding, jogging, and swimming are the norm. It's a different kind of park over here.
We just got a call, juveniles jumping off the Bill Healy Bridge and doing backflips and so forth.
My name's Officer Mark Tischer. I am the Parks Resource Officer with the City of Bend Police Department.
I'm riding along with Officer Tischer as he patrols his beat, more than 50 city parks. We stop at an intersection, and I see two tanned guys chilling at a bus stop. Tischer rolls his window down.
Hey!
Hey, Tischer! How you doing, my man?
Good, brother. What's going on?
Come on, Mike.
Same old?
Chris Bell. Laundry gang, you know?
I recognize those men. For the past two summers, these two have often made Davis Park their daytime home. In a way, they've come to represent the character of the park.
This roundabout.
You guys been keeping Davis Park clean for me?
What's that?
Yep.
Yeah, we're going to the rapids, so meet us down there.
All right.
Okay.
Are you going to body surf it today?
It's 80. I might get wet.
For years, though, Davis Park shenanigans went unpoliced. So Davis Park is now that place, which all cities and towns have, where local customs are at odds with city laws. But about a year ago, the Parks Department proposed building a bridge between the two sides. That got people's attention on my block. Paul Stell is the Natural Resources Manager for the Bend Parks and Recreation District. He says they've tried most everything to enforce local laws and regulations in city parks. The Parks Department even got rid of the park rangers.
Because they didn't have full authority.
They couldn't make citations or arrests or, you know, carry a firearm and take care of business.
Now there's a parks cop. That's who you met earlier, Officer Tischer. The increased law enforcement is necessary, Stell says, because city parks still serve a critical function.
On a hot summer day, it's a great place for anybody. They can be there from, you know, when the park opens till the park closes. And if they don't have any place else to be, that's a good place to be. But there are rules, and we need to follow the rules. That's the only issue.
Here in Bend, the rules are basic. No criminal activity, no endangering the peace and safety of others, no drinking alcohol or possessing an open container without a proper permit. If people can agree to this, Stell says those living close to city parks have an obligation to let it be for the entire public.
Living next to a park is a commitment.
Stell doesn't finish his thought, but I know what he means. Residents have no control over public land bordering their property, and there's a steady flow of different people and habits. So on my block, some homeowners want to project their idea of how the other side of the river should be. People on the west side engage the police, like my neighbor, who I'll call Sam. She didn't want her real name used.
You know, we tried to figure out how to solve this problem.
What problem?
Of unhealthy and unsafe behavior dominating a small community park.
Sam says a group of men show up around 10 each morning in Davis Park. They claim a picnic table and spend all day there, drinking and smoking.
And that would happen every sunny day. Two people would come and secure that picnic table. The hotter it was, the earlier they'd come. So they'd make sure they had it for the whole day.
I asked Sam what she means by unhealthy.
Unhealthy is open container drinking, people getting so intoxicated or high on something that they're yelling at people in the park and across the river, including children.
Okay, walking up. I'll ring the buzzer.
Hi, Jason.
How are you? Okay. So I am recording. Is that okay?
Say what? You're recording, sure.
Yeah, okay.
So have a seat.
Marion lives across the street from Sam. She's another block matriarch. She also wishes Davis Park felt less menacing, but she still likes it here.
There's a wildness about living next to moving water. The voice of God, as the Old Testament says. The sound of water is the voice, I forget, but you can look it up.
Marion says people in Davis Park should be more discreet.
Being part of the community, that if you're going to drink, you should do it surreptitiously rather than out in the open and not get so drunk that you, you know, yell at people and cause a disruption. I mean, it's against the law, having an open container in a park, I do believe.
Marion's a retired lawyer. She spent decades representing people like those across the river. But the way she says that, it's against the law. It's an easy way to make gray situations black and white. We all do it. So I push her to give me a sense of how she feels about it on a human level.
You know what I was thinking about was when I went to college, we studied the contract philosophers. You know, Locke, Berkeley, and Hume. And that the problem with Davis Park is that there's some folks that really don't have any reason to, they're homeless and they're kind of down and out and they're, sounds like having issues with drink and drugs. And so they have no reason to abide by the rules of the community. So there's no social contract. And so the question becomes, well, how do you enforce laws with people like that?
So you want me to do a countdown? 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. My name is Chris Clord. I'm the managing director of the Bethlehem Inn, Central Oregon's largest homeless shelter serving men, women, and families.
Marion got me thinking about social contracts and how exactly we establish customs and laws in places like Davis Park. Clord, A longtime Bend local says for a city its size, the scale of social services here are too small. That means individuals in our community must provide support. And Clouart says that support isn't just food and shelter.
There's a wonderful quote, which is that the law prohibits equally a rich man and a poor man from sleeping under a bridge. A rich man would never need to sleep under a bridge, but the thought that there's a sense of equality there, there's an equivalence there, is ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Bend's got an oversupply of brew pubs and golf clubs. So if a person with a bit of disposable income wants to crack a beer on a hot day, they've got plenty of places to go. But Clouart says many people in Bend have a tough go of it.
Their choices in life are fairly limited. So if you don't have much money and it's a nice summer day, where are you going to go? You're either going to go to the library or you're going to go to a local park, which is your park as much as it's anybody else's park. The question has to be, what are the modes of behavior in that park?
Clouart makes an important distinction between law and custom.
So law is the thing that we tell ourselves we want to do. Custom is what we allow to happen.
Right now, those two are not aligning in Davis Park. Clouart is a humanist. He sees the need for a dialogue between all the park's users. But until that happens, it falls to the police to decide what's allowed and what isn't.
We're going to go look here. Dispatch L63, community policing.
So we're back at the bus stop where Officer Tischer and I have just run into Ron and Matt. Remember when they said this?
Are you going to body surf it today?
It's 80, I might get wet.
After Ron and Matt head off to Davis Park, Tischer shows me their records. He points out a few thefts and DUI charges from back in the early 90s. After a few more hours driving around, Tischer decides to check in on Ron and Matt at the park.
Officer Tischer walking down. He's got his binocs.
We're on the west side of the river looking into Davis Park. We bump into my neighbor, Marion, walking her dog.
Everybody's out. You know, it's sort of like Alaska. This is one of the first lovely days. Everybody's sort of getting their sun.
Hey, Officer Tischer, our champion.
Oh, you're too kind.
I have a spotting scope if you need optics.
Tischer jumps in the patrol car.
Davis Park contact.
Tischer says there's about six people partying, among them two guys on parole that shouldn't be drinking. They could possibly face jail time. Tischer also says one of the parolees can be difficult when he's drunk, so he calls for a backup. And by the time we've driven to Davis Park, a police car carrying two officers rolls in behind us. Tischer questions Ron and Matt, and another guy I know as Mr. Mills. Tischer is interested in their backpacks.
What about the main container, or main pocket?
You got a warrant?
Yeah, you got a warrant?
Ron, I'm going to write you a citation.
Ron, you know? Because it's what I got to do.
Hey,
we've talked for years.
Hey.
This is all of gray backpackers.
That's my brother. Yes, my beyond you.
Beer.
I got closed beers in there, that's right.
All right.
Yes.
Well,
me.
I got closed ones.
Take
I bet I
me.
Wasn't drinking. Hey, Mr. Mills.
I'm just letting
have
you
a seat
know,
on that.
Buddy.
Mr. Mills, sit down right there, please.
Okay.
Whatever, dude.
Mills looks pissed. His face reddens. His muscles tighten. About now, Tischer calls for a third backup.
You're on probation, Mr. Mills?
No, I'm not on nothing, buddy. Not since August 8th of 2000, old boy. So there.
Quite a while?
Yeah.
Why are you upset, Mr. Mills?
Because, man, you want to walk around here. You want to throw some guys around here, man. Run my shit and let me get the hell out of here.
This is the last time.
Right. I ain't coming down here no more. Every time I come down here, the police show up.
The fourth officer shows up. Ron, Matt, and Mr. Mills all seem glad to see him.
Hey, it's about time.
Fields, how are you?
Good, sir. How are you?
I'm good, sir.
Officer Tischer opens his ticket pad and writes Fields a citation and an exclusionary notice, meaning he cannot enter a city park for 3 months. Here's how Ron Fields feels about all this.
Mr. Tischer,
Mr. Fields,
we're not friends anymore.
He's just doing his job.
I told you that 3 months ago.
I know. Not friends. I ain't hurting nobody down here, man.
Bye, guys.
This place just cleared out pretty fast. Wow.
Tisher and I walk back to the police car.
Wow. See how quickly things go south.
Yeah, I can see that.
Had I been watching this scene from across the river, besides the cops, it would have seemed normal. Ron, Matt, and the merrymakers pretty much keeping to themselves. But here's the thing. I'm at the river daily. I notice most people break some sort of law or rule here. Some drink alcohol openly, dogs run amok off-leash, all against city code. And I'm talking most visitors, just regular folks, no different than Ron and Matt, whose biggest crime, perhaps, is treating Davis Park like their living room. Yeah, I have seen Ron and Matt get too drunk, yell at people, but it's been rare. There's been no dialogue, no discussion of what the customs in Davis Park should be. The law has been enforced, but I'm unsure we've made our block a better place. Certainly, it's less welcoming. And the band of ragtag men, they'll simply move on, maybe to another park, the problem's unresolved. Later this summer, on another scorcher, I floated a section of the Deschutes with my two children. Life jackets on, we jumped in a mile upstream from downtown. We carelessly floated, our bodies bobbing all the way. Near downtown, we got out and sun-dried. I looked across the street at the bus stop. There stood Matt, one of the usual suspects at Davis Park. Although this time, he didn't look the part. His big belly exposed to the sun, his arm around his little girl. He'd been floating the river too.
This podcast was edited by Julia Barton with sound direction and production by Caitlin Prest. Our music is by Matthew Darr, Kyle Kaplan, and Todd McDonald. Our funding comes from you, our listeners, and from the Open Society Foundation, with special thanks to Thomas Hilbink. Thanks also to the Tide Center, our nonprofit fiscal sponsor. This podcast was edited by Julia Barton with sound direction and production by Caitlin Prest. Our music is by Matthew Darr, Kyle Kaplan, and Todd McDonald. Our funding comes from you, our listeners, and from the Open Society Foundations, with special thanks to Thomas Hilbink. Thanks also to the Tide Center, our nonprofit fiscal sponsor. If you'd like to make an individual donation to Life of the Law, or are considering becoming a sponsor of our podcast, visit lifeofthelaw.org. I'm Nancy Mullane.
You've been listening to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts. Learn more about these and other great radio podcasts at KALW.org.